Committee for Monday, April 25, is called to order. And welcome all. We will first off open a work session on House Bill 3183. Mr. Keller, would you give us an overview, please?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 3183 changes the method for distribution of income from the Common School Fund to school districts. It has a subsequent referral to revenue. I have a signed letter from the Speaker allowing us to rescind the referral. There are no amendments. And I have a revenue report indicating that there is no revenue. So it's ready to go.
Thank you. I would entertain a motion that we move House Bill 3183.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3183 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 3183 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Revenue be rescinded. Is there discussion? Everyone's fully up to speed and has recollection of the good things with this.
Yes,
good. Those of the opinion, House Bill 3183 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to revenue be rescinded. Will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Clark?
Aye.
Representative
Benz? Aye.
Representative
Rosen? Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative
Dahl?
Aye.
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And if there is no objection, I think we can put this on the consent calendar. We will do so. Thank you. We will close the work session on House Bill 2183.
I'm excited. Can we do that next?
Public hearing. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2919. Mr. Keller, will you please give us an overview?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2919 creates expanded option program for students attending public school in grades 11 and 12 or who are 16 years of age or older, allows eligible students to enroll in post-secondary courses for credit at eligible post-secondary institutions, prohibits institutions from charging student post-secondary course costs, directs resident school districts to enter into agreement with institutions for limited payment of costs from the state school fund grant of school district, establishes cap on number of credit hours that may be awarded at each high school under expanded options program, sunsets credit hours cap June 30th, 2009, and in front of you there are also some dash one amendments.
Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Speaker Flores, and thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity. House Bill 2919 has a long history. I started the process, at least a history in this session. Senator Abel Gordley and I conferred, came to the conclusion that this would be good legislation, and both of us started down that trail. Senator Gordley would like to sit in the empty chair beside me. I did so with her on the Senate side with her bill. However, she has committee assignments of her own, and if she can't get away, will join me and join me late. But she did send a message that whatever I say, she will subscribe to. So we would like to reduce tax. No, I'm sorry. There is a long history and all types of support for this particular piece of legislation. I would like to talk about 1997. John Carnahan, then president of Lynn Benton Community College, and I sat in a meeting with many other people and talked about how we would open up the community college experience to high school graduates, and we looked at those that were having trouble in high school and those that were having a great deal of success in high school and how we might get them in. His statement to me at that time, as we sat side by side, was bring them down. He would charge tuition only. His only concern at that time was for age. We had a student that I believe was 12 that wanted to take part in the program, and President Kernahan thought that might be just a little bit young for the college education experience, and off he went to deal with that, and off I went to send students. As recently as last Thursday, Klamath Community College, Dr. Fred Smith, whom I count as a colleague and who I look up to for his innovative notions, is going to present to his board tomorrow night a notion that students in the Klamath Community College area will be able to attend their community college without tuition charge. He is going to open the doors of the community college to those that are able. I did see the policy note that he had passed around to his board. There are a few, they're working out a few exceptions, but I applaud him for that. It would seem that he could sit at this table with Senator Gordley and myself. When this piece of legislation was first presented in this session, it ran into some tough sledding. As I talked with the senator, we decided that I would submit this piece of legislation. However, since that time on the Senate side, they were able to put together a work group. The work group was chaired by Harvey Matthews, co-chaired by Harvey Matthews of AOI and Chuck Bennett of COSA. I monitored its progress closely. Many participants were involved. Oregon University System, OUS, the community colleges, OCCA, school boards, OSBA, the Department of Ed, ODE, and parent volunteers.
I would interrupt Representative Dahl and say that you missed AOI and COSA, and we're still funding Education First here. Please proceed.
I wouldn't have missed them, but I didn't know what COSA meant.
So. I'm sure they'll let you know.
I'm completely disjointed now.
With my apologies.
I do have some concerns with the legislation, but as I review it with those that work very hard to get it through the Senate side, I believe it's the very best we can do. I would like, right now we're limited to 16 years and older. There's a cap on the number of quarter credits. It does not provide for a summer school program. I would like to move closer to the Washington model. I would like to remove the sunset. But basically, the amendments that are in front of you are a copy of Senate Bill 300, a bill that Senator Gordley and that committee has worked very hard on, and I would like this to be a companion piece to that. I think it's the best we can do, and with that, I'll begin the questions that you have.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for Representative Gollum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In all this discussion, I know we're looking at trying to improve the education for the students. And some school districts already do this. I
guess. Yes, they do.
But have we gotten an idea of what kind of a cost has been?
Yes, right now one half of the state-provided funding would go to up to one half. To the supplying institution. And I might say, Representative March, that we got into this not because we have schools, and we have schools that are doing great things. And I'm sure I'll have one of the committee members up here behind me, and you can ask me how that committee went. I did not take part in that myself, but my particular concern was I was aware of several cases where school districts adamantly discouraged attendance at the community college level. In fact, the state was made that if you went to community college, you couldn't graduate, you couldn't get dual credit. For myself, I was very interested in remedying that. And right now, we're at a split. It would be a maximum for the community college to receive.
Thank you.
Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. The first one has to do with when the student is going to the community college, they wouldn't be charged. There would be an agreement with the school district.
Yes, there is.
And then they would still be collecting their ADM for that student.
Yes, they would.
Okay. Maximum credits. I guess that's really. I want to make sure you both got to do that. So
both schools get to do that, and then the public school would pay up to a maximum of one half the state allocation, but not necessarily one half, but up to that. So both institutions will continue to collect their state support. The school would just provide some of it to community college for services rendered.
Additional questions?
I would like to take my chair. I have a few questions for myself.
Well, then, you and yourself can have that conversation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. And I'd like to thank you and the committee for going easy.
It's a good thing. Deb Andrews and Margaret DeLacy, please.
Chairman Flores, members of the committee, my name is Deb Andrews. I'm from Portland. I want to thank you very much for bringing this bill forward and having a public hearing. I was a member of that work group on Senate Bill 300. I think this provides opportunities for children that they might not ordinarily have. At risk is defined as free and reduced lunch. It seemed a reasonable thing that was statewide, and people understood what that meant. This bill will facilitate students accomplishing more than they dreamed possible, highlight the need for education to be considered a seamless K-16 endeavor. I have two concerns. My first is that students younger than 16 often have an extreme need to go to post-secondary education at that age, at a younger age than 16. I would very much like to see an appeal process for these students to appeal to the Oregon Department of Education if they have an extreme need to attend post-secondary education prior to the age of 16. My second concern with the amended bill is Section 10, Subsection C. This was added at the last hour when many of the workgroup members had left the meeting, last meeting that we had on this bill. Subsection C effectively guts the bill. I would like to see that eliminated. Thank you.
Subsection C. 10. No. Thank you.
Ready? Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, am I on? For the record, my name is Margaret DeLacy. I am the mother of three children. I live in Portland, and I also served on the work committee for the Senate version of this bill, which was Senate Bill 300. I'm a little bit unprepared today because I called this morning and I was told that you were not hearing the -1 amendments, the amendments that were made to the Senate bill. So I prepared testimony on Senate Bill 300 and not on the amended version, but I would like to make a couple of comments on the amendments. I share Ms. Andrews' concern about the same provisions of the bill. I was a strong supporter of the concept of this bill. In fact, my first experience in testifying in the legislature was for a predecessor of this bill called the Student Bill of Rights when it was put forward by Monique Lloyd in, I think, 1999. It was quite an experience. I'd never been up here before. And I'd like to begin by asking you to think of any Oregon student under 18 who has no right to learn in school. I hope that none of you can come up with any child who has no right to learn in school. Unfortunately, we already have quite a few of them who are sitting in school classes and are not learning. And I don't think that there should be any exemption from the idea that any student has a right to learn in school for students who happen to be high achievers. Unfortunately, many of them are being warehoused. And the last time I came, I think I distributed achievement gain results that demonstrate that pretty clearly, that these students are making close to zero or zero gains. Other states, including Washington State, have done a much better job. Their Running Start program has been incredibly successful and, in addition, has saved taxpayers and the state $57 million. I don't think that we have that kind of money to waste here in Oregon. We could reap similar savings and also improve education for our kids. I'd also like to add that in Washington, the number of students who take AP classes has risen quite substantially since Running Start came into effect. There's absolutely no evidence that programs like this undermine or undercut AP and similar IB, similar advanced placement classes in any way. Now, I'd like to talk about some problems that I see in the bill that you have before you. First, participation is limited to students who are 16 and over. And I distributed, this weekend I received the latest edition of the Gifted Child Quarterly, which is the research publication of the National Association for Gifted Children, which points out that there are children who need to be accelerated. I apologize for the language in this report, by the way. I didn't write the jargon. But I'd like to quote from it. Acceleration, including radical acceleration by 3 or more years, is a most successful intervention, according to the research. According to this article, when schools force extremely gifted students to stay with classmates of the same age, they typically underachieve and experience negative affective outcomes. That means they're unhappy and have trouble with their friendships, including lowered self-esteem, anxiety, and serious demotivation. In other words, they lose interest in being successful in school. Section 8 of the original bill also limits enrollments to no more than 2 academic years. Many students would benefit significantly if this limitation was removed, and the most obvious example, it seems to me, are students who want to start a foreign language in their sophomore year and who would like to take that foreign language for 3 years while they're in high school. It seems to me that it's to Oregon's benefit to have more Oregonians who are fluent in a wider range of languages than are currently taught in our high schools, particularly in our rural high schools. Most colleges and community colleges do offer that wider range of languages. Second, the bill has a strict limit on the number of credit hours that a high school must provide. That credit limit works out to approximately 9 full-time equivalent students per year in a school of 1,000, and the cap is prorated for schools that have more or less than 1,000 students. If a student needs a class, I don't understand why we wouldn't offer it to that student just because there was a, you know, it was a 10th student instead of a 9th student who needed to take that class. In fact, I don't understand why we would tell any public school student that they have no right to take an appropriate class. I just don't think that it's in our interest, in their interest, or in anyone's interest to set a limit on the amount of education a student can participate in before they turn 18. I also don't think it's in our interest to pay taxes to warehouse students who are simply not learning in classes where they are now. It's a total waste of my taxpayer money and of those students' time. At a minimum, I would recommend that you amend this bill to permit any school district the option of extending the cap if it wishes to. I don't think that there's any, this proved to be a totally non-controversial issue in the work group. I don't see why anybody would object to giving them that option. I would prefer that you strike the whole section or at least retain the sunset so that the section will expire in 2009. The sunset was eliminated by the work group, so right now that enrollment cap will continue in perpetuity if you adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Finally, the bill requires every district to create its own definition of at-risk students, the original bill. This means that eligibility will vary from district to district across the state, and a student who moves from one area to another may have to play by different rules once they've moved. I think that whatever rule is written should be applied statewide. And I agree with Ms. Andrews that if it's basically a financial bill, the students who are at risk should be defined as low-income students if the rule must be retained. Finally, I'd like to talk directly to one of the amendments that was added by the work group. This is the same section. It's section 10C. It reads, school districts that offer dual credit, tech prep, advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and other accelerated learning programs are exempt from the financial obligations of this act if these programs serve all qualified applicants and there are no charges to students who qualify for free and reduced lunch programs. Notice that the district is exempt if the district offers any of these classes. So in a large district, if you have a school at one end of the district that offers, let's say, a tech prep program, the whole district is exempt even if students in other schools have to travel all the way across the district to participate in these programs, and even if they happen to have a community college right across the street. To me, this makes absolutely no sense. It's also confusing and ambiguous. In the work group, the participants interpreted this clause in very different ways. ODE had one interpretation. The Oregon Department of Education had one interpretation, and the Oregon Education Association had a second interpretation. And I believe that in the upshot, you may end up with confusion among the school districts or legal issues pertaining to the interpretation of this clause. It seems to me that it could be read to mean that any school district that provides any advanced opportunity, no matter how relevant, without charge to low-income students will be totally exempt from the act. I think in that case, it would exempt virtually every school district in the state, and I'm afraid that if this clause continues, the bill will in fact have very little effect. Finally, to sum up, if students are qualified and ready to participate in college-level work, and I might add that this bill includes distance learning and dual credit courses that are taught on a high school campus. So it isn't necessarily required for these students to leave and go to the college. They could stay in their high school and take this college level work for credit. And that's one reason I think that there should be a process for students under 16. If college level class is offered in the high school, I don't see why you would say, well, you're just a sophomore, you're not going to be allowed to take it this year. If students are qualified and they're ready for this work, I think they should be allowed to take it. And I think that they should be allowed to take it even if there happen to be more than 9 of them in any single high school. I estimate there are probably about 150 who could benefit. And even if they happen to be younger than 16. To do anything else simply wastes our money and their time. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Lacey? Representative Roblin.
In that, there is an exception for school districts to exceed the number of credits. In that same deal, if you look at the bottom of that page, and I just want to make sure that you'd read that.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, are we talking about the original bill or the -1 amendment?
-1 amendment. Under Section 17, number 3, a school district may choose to exceed the credit hour cap established in Sections 1 and 2 of this section.
Oh, okay. I apologize. Yes, when I originally prepared these remarks this morning, I didn't realize you'd be looking at the -1 amendments.
Okay, yes, I understand that.
But my understanding is that on the Senate side, that the sunset was removed and the credit hour cap was retained. I'm sorry. It'd probably be best for me to go home and read this and get back to you on that. Yeah.
Representative Solomon, did you want to address that?
Yes, this is just taking another look, the end of Section 17 says that if credit hours are exceeded, the school district board shall establish a process for selecting eligible students. So it just sets out who gets priority to participate if there are more than the 330 credit hours requested. It doesn't permit exceeding that limit, as far as I can
read
tell.
Read the one just before that, number 3.
On page 11.
Oh, okay.
Three
yeah.
gives them, and four.
Three,
only if
three,
they're not willing.
Right. Three permits the. You're correct. I'm sorry. I missed that in the.
Madam Chair.
Representative Roblin, follow up.
Just. Thank you. And there is nothing in here that, as I read, and I just got the -1
yeah.
and 2, so I'm going to quickly. That won't allow a district to grant students under 16 from taking credits, is there?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, eligible students are defined as students who are over 16 or juniors or seniors in high school. So the rest of the bill is written for eligible students, and they are ineligible.
But I mean, we have districts that are currently doing this without this bill. I don't think this would stop them from having an agreement for younger.
Madam Chair and Representative Roblin, you're correct. There are provisions in the bill that sunset or that grandfather in existing programs. If a district has an existing program, they can continue it. What this bill does is exempt students who are 16 or under from participation in this specific option. My concern is that if you've got, let's say, a credit class that's being taught in the high school, a dual credit class, and you've got a student who's 16, younger than 16, there may be no way of dealing with that additional student if the program is funded by extended options.
Thank you.
is any other questions? Representative Marsh?
I just wanted to make a point that the you mentioned programs that schools opting out of the program, they have to request a waiver, and that's on page 8. C, the paragraphs underneath that are how they could apply for a waiver from these requirements. But so that might help ease a little bit some of your concern. But on a broader question, would I know you've got concerns about the age 16 and the sunset provisions. If it came down to, would you rather continue under existing law, or would you rather start us down this path?
Senator, Representative Flores and Representative March, Section C, I believe, only deals with the funding, the 50% funding limit. Again, I'll have to go back and reread this amendment. In addition, Representative March, my strong preference would be either to adopt a program that is more similar to Running Start or to adopt Senate Bill 300 as it was originally written rather than the Dash 1 amendments, which I believe could have the effect of rendering the rest of the bill ineffective.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much.
Harvey Matthews and Julie Sihanic. Oh, and Ms. Laurie Wimmer Whalen. Oh, and we'll call you. Don't get all in a twither. Okay.
All together.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Harvey Matthews. I work with Associated Oregon Industries, and seated here with us are some of the other members of the work group that toiled long and hard on Senate Bill 300. We met five meetings over 25 hours. It was long and grueling, and what you see before you is the result of an attempt by several different interest groups to achieve balance. A balance between funding for our K-12 schools and our higher education facilities, a balance between existing programs and new programs, a balance between rules that we want to set to protect students and also exceptions to those rules, and balance between sunsets and a reporting mechanism that would allow you to review and make amendments to this bill. This group was motivated very strongly by some of the existing programs and Senator Avell Gordley's desire that we all share to make sure that we don't just have a bunch of programs throughout the state, but instead we have a statewide system that would allow students to access college. So with that, I want to encourage you strongly to support the Dash 1 amendments that Representative Dahlem has brought forward and move the bill. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen representing the Oregon Education Association. And we'd like to echo Mr. Matthews' remarks about this work group process. I've been in this building for 15 years, and I would say this is the most constructive and productive work group that I've ever had the pleasure to participate on. As many of you probably know, the Oregon Education Association has opposed this bill for three prior sessions of the legislature, and we stand here reversing our position today. And support the Dash 1 amendments because we feel that everything that Mr. Matthews said about balance is, I mean, it took the words right out of my mouth. We were very concerned that we be able to offer programs for students who don't have access to those currently, although 33,000 students around the state do have some sort of concurrent credit program access of one sort or another right now. This would just add to that mix and bring them all together in kind of a concerted, more organized way. And but we also cared about those kids for whom the traditional high school setting is more appropriate or more their choice. And we wouldn't want to have to choose one set of kids over another. The idea here was to make sure that there was enough financial stability and flexibility that every local district could create or make the choices on behalf of their students that were most appropriate for them. And we believe that the Dash 1 amendments to this bill reflect that desire. And we were very pleased to be a part of that work group, and we urge you to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Julie Sahonik. I'm the Government Relations for the Oregon Community College Association, and we are also in support of Dash 1 amendments. I won't copy what was already been said, but to let you know that I think the overwhelming feeling of this committee, this work group to focus on this bill, was that this is a first step. What we tried to do is really commit to the innovation and the ideas that are going on already throughout the state with the great partnerships between K-12 and community colleges, and just make sure that every student that goes to a K-12 that does meet these eligibility standards has this ability to move forward in their education. We believe that that is a growing trend nationwide, and we want Oregon to be a leader in that trend. We know that this is a first step. We all expect that in the next 2 years we'll learn a lot about what the program looks like, and we will likely be back in front of this committee and the Senate Education Committee looking for tweaks so that we can make this program even more student-focused than we've already intended it to be. I'd be happy to answer any questions once you kind of hear the rest of the scoop.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. We, too, were members of the work group and came into the work group with one purpose in mind, and that was how can we create more opportunities for students while they're still in high school to begin to think about post-secondary opportunities. And we looked at it as a way to create more relevance for those students, both students, groups of students that may be at risk of dropping out, those students that have dropped out. The bill itself creates, if you will, an incentive for those students to come back because they now have opportunities to begin to think about starting their post-secondary work while they're still in high school. There was a lot of give and take in the work group. Obviously, each of us brought to the table various interests, and what we tried to do was preserve the programs that, as was said earlier, are currently serving over 33,000 students already earning concurrent credit. So how can we start a new program without, in effect, doing away with those cooperative agreements that have created those? How can we create opportunities for students, which in effect will require a school district to bungle up some resources for those students to begin their post-secondary work, students in this program to begin that post-secondary work, while at the same time trying to create some protections for school districts so it didn't create too heavy a financial drain. And so there was a lot of give and take in the work group, and we believe that what was produced in the form of the Dash 1 amendments that you're looking at balances all those interests and is a good product and will give us a starting point by which we can measure how well we're doing in 2 years given the reporting requirements and so forth. We'll have a better track record. So we're encouraged by the prospects that this bill offers and would encourage you to advance it forward. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, we were in support of Senate Bill 300. We joined in the work group and support the Dash 1 amendments. Fundamentally, our concern is that we come out of this session with one really substantive education policy piece and believe this really represents an opportunity for high school students to both have enriched programs and to begin to experience post-secondary education. This is a bill that has been around for several sessions in an era where we are talking increasingly about P16. This really is P16, and it's the Dash 1 amendments, while they don't take us as far as some of us think we could go, get us started down this road in a really dramatic fashion with all education advocates on board, which is an unusual thing, having been through this for three sessions, getting all of the groups headed the same direction. And in support of this kind of legislation is really unusual, and I'm really pleased we've gotten this far and that we're over here in the House talking about, I realize not the Senate bill but a House version, but that we're talking about this in both chambers now, I think is real exciting. It's been a long time coming, so we certainly encourage you to support this bill with its -1 amendments and keep this coalition of groups together. And we'll be back, I think, in the future to talk to you about expanding this program. I think we all need to have some experience with it, and I think we'll be back. This is a very good direction, and it's real exciting, I think, what you have an opportunity to do here. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. Not much I can add other than to say that, as Ms. Wimmer-Whalen had mentioned, this bill has been here before the legislature on numerous occasions, and in my many years in this building, I have actually never participated in a work group where we've made such headway, and we've been able to work together in honest ways and have really frank discussions. And I want to thank everybody on this work group for that. It was very heartening. The Oregon University System supported Senate Bill 300, and we would support House Bill 2919 in its original form. We did have, at that time, serious concerns about the funding issues. We did not want to project any funding concerns or problems on any of our education partners. So we were anxious and excited to participate in that work group to realize some compromises and some way that we can make this work. We would encourage your adoption of the -1 amendments to 2919 and to move the bill in this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel or any of the other participants? I just have a quick question, and perhaps could you give us the discussion that might have surrounded the concerns that were addressed previously about students who might fall under the 16-year limitation of obviously high-achieving students? The Doogie Howsers of the world.
The really gifted among us. Yeah. Madam Chair, we needed to start somewhere on a bill like this, and there certainly are, there is no question there are going to be exceptional students of any age. We could go down to 7th and 8th grade and find exceptional students who might be able to participate in this, and we may at some point. But this was not the bill and not the time and certainly not the economic conditions for public education, we felt, to try to push that issue all the way through. We fully expect there will be discussion of this, but this confined a population. It allows everyone to find out how this is going to work. There, again, third session, there's a lot of trepidation about this kind of direction. I think everyone wants to know how it's going to work. I have no doubt we'll talk about this in the future, but we needed a limit, and 16 was the limit. This is for high school kids. This is for juniors and seniors. I mean, we had that was the kind of discussion that went on. Who is the population we're targeting here? And this was not designed to target younger children. That's not what this program at this point had in mind. That's how I remember the discussion anyway.
Mr. Matthews,
right.
Did you wish to comment?
Yes, Harvey Matthews, once again. I think what we tried to do was to make sure that existing programs within schools that attempted to provide advanced learning opportunities to students on the campus were protected. But there were concerns from our higher education partners that there might be liability associated with having students younger than 16 on the campus. And I think they want to talk to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess you're out of there, John.
Much prettier to look at.
Doesn't mean we don't love you, John.
Julissa Honick, Oregon Community College Association, again, just to address that issue, I think we have to remember what we're inviting the students into. Even though we're giving them these accelerated opportunities, the community colleges are an adult campus. specifically for our students who are on the average age of 36 or older. We have a promise to those students when they come to community college that they are going to have an adult experience. And in the sense that when they come into the classroom, they're going to expect a level of maturity and a level of questions. And what we have found is that that's also very good for those students who are able to come in and be successful in that environment. They often find that working with the older adults or people with real-world experience can help them mature and realize what the potential is out there. But that we have not only we have a promise to the students that we are currently serving, but that we also expect that the students coming into this environment will have a maturity. We don't hold the hands of our students that come into the environment. We provide them with the advising and counseling, but this is a role for them to come in and learn what college life is like. And we have concerns that once we go below 16, that could be a factor. Our doors aren't closed to students who are younger than 16, but those are options that the parents and those school districts need to look at on their own, and that defining this expanded options program was one of the criteria for that.
Madam Chair, again, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. We shared that concern. We do have campuses who have, it is an adult environment, and there are just a little bit of different cultures and different factors that weigh in when you're on a university campus. And we did have that concern, and we shared that with the parents on the work group. And that was our position, and I believe that that's a best way to start, to really take a look and see how that's going to work.
And I believe that issue has been handled. Two people that were mentioned earlier in testimony, Monique Lloyd and John Carnahan, ironed out that issue, and I believe that under 16 was exempted, but only on a case-by-case basis. So I have no concern about the 16-year-old.
And Madam Chair, Representative Dalmon, we're very anxious to see how that works, and I think that will be a great model for us to watch. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Andrews, did you want to make a follow-up comment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Deb Andrews, Portland. I want to address that as far as the level of maturity on campus, there are 13-year-olds that are tutoring organic chemistry on college campus. We cannot blanket generalize with these students. If we have students younger than 16 that have the need to save their life, to take the class, and they are poor and cannot afford, their parents cannot afford to pay the cost of tuition, this bill would allow them that opportunity, and it should be provided to them. As far as safety, there could be a requirement that their guardian accompanies them to the class door. Not go inside and get a free education, but accompany them to the class door if that's the concern. My concern is that we make a way for them to learn. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Any questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Lacey.
Madam Chair, I would just like to point out that we did not request blanket admission for these students. We requested an appeals process for these students. That was written into the bill and was eliminated at the last minute. I'm not suggesting that students should be admitted wholesale. I'm just suggesting that if they're already suitable and are admitted by the school, which must admit them under this bill, so that school has already decided that they're suitable, and they have then appealed, that they should be considered. I don't see this as like a wholesale opening the college doors to any student who thinks it's going to be fun, but we do think a responsible appeal process has its place. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Wimmer-Whalen.
Madam Chair, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. Not to belabor the point, but I thought your record should reflect that in that conversation that we held about this, one of the things that we include in that group of 33,000 students who are already doing this are advanced placement courses, international baccalaureate programs, distance learning opportunities, courses through colleges online, My own son is an IB candidate at Lincoln High School and also has taken off-campus courses through some of these other options. They exist now, very reasonably priced if you pay anything at all, and certainly for the IB program, the International Baccalaureate, which I already said, there is a waiver for low-income students. So there are ways for low-income students to participate in those programs that are already being offered. So we felt that it wasn't that there were no opportunities for students younger than 16, but that there were opportunities on the high school campus, which we felt that in addition to academic precocity, you also want to consider the emotional maturity level of students and the liability issues. And so on balance, we felt that there were doors that were open already. So that was what I wanted to add to the record.
Thank you. Did you have a question at this point?
I do.
Representative Roman?
It has to do with the same age group kids. We do have a requirement to have a TAG program in each school district, and you could write that into your TAG program with regard to certain expectations. And would there be any concern of that with, from your perspective or anybody else in the committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Roman, I'm not sure if I understand the question entirely, how you write it into your TAG.
Each school district is required to have a plan dealing with their TAG students, and it would be possible for a school district to write into their plan the option of giving this to particular kids that are TAG based on certain criteria that you develop in that program, i.e. their maturity level, the ability to do classes, and so on. Would there be a problem with this bill the way it's written to allow that to happen?
Madam Chair and Representative Roland, all of this is predicated on the notion that there's a higher education institution that accepts the student.
Right.
And so I think that would be the only stumbling block, is if the university or the community college in question felt that there was an issue. But as I said, oftentimes if that is an insurmountable barrier, there is another option, such as an advanced placement IB course or some other kind of program that the student can take on the high school campus to get the same quality of educational opportunity.
Okay. Harvey Matthews. One very important element of this is Section 18, and in that section it describes that the Department of Education will annually report on the Expanded Options Program to the Joint Boards of Education and the House and Senate committees relating to several issues. And subpoint 9 says specifically recommendations for changes to the Expanded Options Program to better serve students, including changes to the age limit restrictions for eligible students. Again, this whole bill is delicately balanced, and what we tried to do was make sure there is a feedback loop for the legislature to review these various elements, including the age restriction element, so that we could move forward in a way that would bring all the interest groups along. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. And I thank you all for your information to bring us fast forward on this. And I think we've covered everybody there. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2919. I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2919. And
Madam Chairman, I would like to say that given the balance, and I have visited with members of the committee, not all, but most, and they have worked hard, and the balance is as close as we're going to bring this piece of legislation. We will be doing a look back, and I will be doing a look back in 2007. And with that, I recommend a do pass amendment to the floor. But first, I move the dash one amendments to the bill.
Representative Dollar moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2919. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lynn, and by the way, I do apologize for not officially welcoming you back from your very highly regarded trip to...
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I have a small question here. Section 1 and page 2, line 12, eligible student does not include foreign exchange student enrolled in a school under a cultural exchange program. Could someone explain to me why the exchange student does not include it? who can explain that?
I can speak to you.
Mr. Matthew, would you like to come back up? Do you have any information on that? Well, let's see what sticks.
Chair Flores, Representative Lim. A lot of this legislation was based upon what was written previously in the 2003 session, and so I think that was one of the aspects that was grandfathered in. I believe the concern that grandfathered that in originally was that we were trying to limit the exposure of school districts to financial hazard, I guess, and so we wanted to focus that tuition issue primarily on students whose parents were paying their income taxes here in the state. That's my best guess. Did that stick?
Well, it sounds like a good starting point. Mm-hmm. Representative Dahl.
I think we might get one more sticking point. When a foreign exchange student signs up to visit our country, they come for the American experience in the American high school. And to move them out of the high school and onto the college campus is contrary to what the intent of an exchange program is. And so it only makes sense that you leave them on the high school campus. That's what they're here for.
Representative Rowland?
I was going to say basically the same thing, as well as the insurance that they come with and other kinds of things oftentimes stipulate exactly what's going to happen and who they're covering. And I think some other issues may come about in those arrangements that the different exchange programs has with the particular high school. So I agree with Representative Dahl. I think that's there's a whole lot of reasons.
Does that address your question, Representative?
That's addressed my question. But when they come as exchange student, they don't pay at all to the high school at all?
No.
They don't pay?
No.
Okay. All right. That satisfies my question.
It stuck. Thank you. Any further discussion on the Dash-Win amendments? Representative Dahlem has moved. Oops. Seeing no objections, then we will move the Dash-1 amendments to House Bill 2919.
Madam Chairman, I recommend it do pass as amended to the floor, any reference to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 2919 to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation with a prior referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? All of those of the opinion that House Bill 2919 as amended should be adopted will move to the floor, and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means will vote aye. All of those opposed will vote no. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received the required majority, the House Bill 2919-1, as amended, will be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We will close the work session on House Bill 2919. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3172. Mr. Keller, will you give us an overview, please?
House Bill 3172 abolishes Teacher Standards and Practice Commission, transfer duties, functions, and powers of commission to the State Board of Education and Department of Education, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2005, as a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. I have Linda Samick and Karen Hamlin, please. And guest.
Madam Chair, my name should be on there also, I believe.
Is that Mannion?
Correct.
Thank you very much.
Chair Flores and committee. My name is Linda Samick. I'm the Dean of Graduate Studies and Director of Teacher Education at Western Baptist College here in Salem. I'm also the current chair of the Oregon Association of Colleges for Teacher Education and secretary for the Oregon Independent Colleges Association Deans and Directors of Teacher Ed. With your permission, I'd like to begin with a statement from Dr. Thomas Green, who is the Associate Dean of Education at the University of Portland, who is not able to be with us today. For the record, this testimony is from Thomas Green, Associate Dean of the School of Education at the University of Portland and former Assistant Superintendent in the Gresham, Barlow, and Beaverton School Districts. Dr. Samick is kind enough to read my testimony, as long-scheduled matters on campus keep me from attending the meeting. House Bill 3172 seeks to eliminate Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I would like to offer a few comments on why that is not a good idea. First, licensure is important to professionals. It is important that the matter of educator licensure remain in the hands of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Because the commission is controlled by commissioners who are members of the profession and the general public, such involvement in licensure is critical in the future development of the teaching profession. Second, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission is an efficient agency with a single focus. This means it is nimble and responsive to the needs of pre-K through 12 Oregon students and to the profession. If Teacher Standards and Practices Commission were eliminated, licensure, investigations, and discipline would clog an already full agenda for the State Board of Education and the under-resourced Oregon Department of Education. I would venture to suggest that no money would be saved in the elimination of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission because a requisite number of Oregon Department of Education staff members would be required to handle the workload. Further, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission has made some tremendous strides in the last few years in efficiencies regarding the issuance of licenses. Third, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission is an agency that brings many of the stakeholders in teacher education together, teacher and administrator unions, school board associations, higher education, and district and Department of Education personnel and the public to discuss matters of mutual interest. This efficiency of communication is little recognized byproduct of the public meetings held by Teacher Standards and Practices. This communication would not occur around the public meetings of the State Board of Education because the agenda is more diverse and the net impact would be a less coordinated system of teacher education and licensure. Fourth and finally, the separation of licensure from all other agencies involved in educational matters in the state means that educators are not facing the same agency involved in pre-K to 12 educational change, funding, and standardization. Separation of licensure from these other functions reduces the potential for conflict of interest. The Oregon Department of Education and Teacher Standards and Practices Commission are already collaborative agencies, but they are currently separate. Teacher Standards and Practices Commission is not involved in elected politics. Licensure should not be commingled with elected politics, and since the superintendent of public instruction is elected, this has the potential to make licensure, investigations, and discipline fodder for political campaigns. This would not be good for either the Department of Education or Teacher Standards and Practices. There are many reasons why TSPC should not be eliminated. I would enumerate several others, but I have elected to highlight these four in this brief testimony. I respectfully request your consideration of my concerns and urge the committee to not move House Bill 3172 to the floor. Respectfully submitted, Dr. Thomas Green. Madam Chair, I would like to continue with some brief testimony of my own. As chair of the Oregon Association of Colleges for Teacher Education over the last year and a half, we've had many opportunities to work with agencies and professional organizations and the public around the state, and we appreciate that opportunity. Teacher Standards and Practices Commission became an independent agency in the early 1970s as part of the effort to professionalize education. Teachers, school administrators, school counselors, and psychologists are prepared, licensed, and disciplined under the supervision of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. As a commission of our peers, the agency has become a vital part of the educational enterprise and its continuous improvement in the state of Oregon. Oregon has long been viewed by the rest of the nation as a model of professionalism and excellence in education. Dismantling Teacher Standards and Practices Commission would seriously harm this endeavor. Several other western states, including Wyoming, Hawaii, and California, also have independent licensing agencies, and they often look to Oregon for leadership on this issue. In a former position that I held, I had the opportunity to interact on numerous occasions with counterparts of the Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission from other states. These folks always expressed envy at our opportunity in Oregon to work cooperatively, directly, and frequently with groups comprised of a state agency, unions, professional organizations, and higher education in the same room focused on the same goals. This collaboration does not occur frequently in other states with licensing agencies that are housed in state departments of education. As an independent agency with a clear charge to prepare, license, and monitor educators, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission can focus on providing information, expertise, and vision for the educators of the state of Oregon. I would fully concur with the comments from Dr. Thomas Green. I would also assure you that although I've not had an opportunity to speak with all of the deans and directors, there are 19 of those folks in institutions around the state, but the majority of them would concur as well and would agree with those comments. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Karen Hamlin, Director of the School of Education at Willamette University, and I'm here today to speak against House Bill 3172 and to concur with the comments of Dr. Samick and Dr. Tom Green. During the last 15 years that I've been at Willamette University, we have appreciated a positive working relationship with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. That level of success has led me to believe that teacher licensure should remain in its current form. In my role, I work closely with the TSPC staff and commissioners in the licensure of our graduates and in teacher education accreditation. The Willamette faculty, staff, and I find the TSPC staff and commissioners to be accessible, informed, and responsive to our needs. Critical to us are those direct lines of communication that Dr. Samick mentioned through multiple venues, and we believe that those currently exist in its current structure. We have also appreciated the composition of the commission, which brings together appropriate stakeholders, including folks from both public and private institutions. Its broad perspective is important to the decisions of the commission. In its current structure, TSPC has been aware of and responsive to the needs of the private institutions, such as Willamette. We're confident that in its current structure that will continue to enjoy the level of service and responsiveness as we work together to prepare the next generation of teachers. So I appreciate your attention to those of us coming to you from higher education in not moving forward this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Mannion. I'm the director of the education program at Concordia University up in Northeast Portland. I've got five words that I want to share with you. And the first one, speaking against 3172, but the first word is a critical one, and both of my colleagues have also shared some information regarding that word, and that word is value. We have an opportunity here in our state to have something of great value, and that is our licensing commission, and I mean that very sincerely. Just a few moments ago, Dr. Samick said, I was former OACTE chair. Well, you're current CTE chair. I'm former OACTE chair, and I know that those 19 other members of that committee would be here with us if they could today to say the same thing. We have something of extreme value that other states really want to emulate. Right now, only 11 states have an independent licensing commission, and they want to move forward and have the same type of thing we have today. 3172 would really take us back a step for many of the reasons enunciated. But my second word after value is the word independence. We all know how critical it is to be independent. We watch our kids grow up, they become independent, they become adults, and we're proud of them. But there's a different kind of independence here, the independence to make decisions, where you know those decisions can be for the best of children, for the best of a teaching force, without necessarily having to look behind you and worry about what political favors or other issues might be apparent. And I also mean that sincerely, because that independence of operation is critical. No one in my 15 years of working with the commission has ever taken advantage of that independence. They have been honest and above board, and as Karen mentioned just a few moments ago, an absolute joy to work with. That leads me to the third word, composition. The individuals that are brought together to work on the issue of teacher licensing, the standards we want for our teachers working with our own children. There are so many disparate groups. We've got public school educators. We've got practitioners in K-12 education. We've got higher education. We've got professionals. We've got John Q. Public. And we have had an absolute opportunity to work together as a group, looking not at all of our own selfish interests, but looking ahead at what is in the best interests of the children of our state. When our teachers go into the classroom, are they the best prepared? That independence is absolutely critical. That composition is critical. And the E, the fourth word, I was thinking of example. Again, going back to something I said when I spoke about value, how we have served for many years as an example of so many other states in our region and even nationally regarding things like work samples. Who's been promoting that? The Licensing Commission, TSPC. It's not a dirty word. It's a good word. I said I can speak for my 19 colleagues. I can speak for 17 full-time faculty at Concordia University. I can speak for 52 partner faculty at that same school. I can speak for over 500 students who value what the commission does and who follows closely what the commission does and who listens intently to what the commission does because of its credibility and its believability. Last word, diet. We all think about diets. You know, it is the Atkins diet, the South Beach diet, you know, and we look at diets because we want to be healthy. We want to be healthy. And I want to end by saying we have to look at education in our state. We know financially we have to get things in order, but we don't want to take a big step backwards for the health of our education in this state and the training of our teachers in this state by passing 3172. So those are my five words. And thank you very much for the opportunity to address you and tell you about a commission I believe in and trust. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the staff? Representative
Dolan. You talk about, and we have a list in front of us of the states, and there's, I believe, 11 others that use this system, and we're the envy of the other 39. Why aren't they moving to our system?
You've been there.
I have. A number of them are, and one of the reasons that they are not is that they don't have strong backing from higher ed and from the teachers' groups, the administrators' groups around their states, and so they just continue with business as usual. I will tell you that in visiting with people from Utah, Montana, Idaho, Alaska, and numerous other states over the last few years, from inside the agency, it's very difficult for them to deal with all of the issues that we have to work with educators these days, and they would like to do that. I would guess that they don't have time to think about how to do this, some of them. A number of them are actually in the process. I mentioned Hawaii. They're a fairly new state with an independent licensing agency. The state of Washington has moved closer to an independent agency with a board that oversees their testing structure for educators. And there are others around the nation who are moving that direction as well. And I don't know of anyone at the moment who's moving the other direction from having an independent agency to reincorporating it into their state Department of Education.
A follow-up question. You talked about work samples and that being one of the things that Teacher Standards and Practices has pushed. Do we have work samples in other states?
How many states? You already.
Well, actually.
I'm going to defer to Dr. Samick because she served on. You worked.
Yeah. Chair Flores and Representative Dolan, I would share with you that 2 weeks ago I was in Montreal at the annual meeting of the American Educational Research Association, and there were a number of sessions at that conference where states were talking about the use of teacher work sample methodology. It's something that is growing around the country, Colorado, Kentucky, institutions in California, and a number of other states are beginning work with teacher work sample because it has been a very effective way of evaluating teacher effectiveness in a classroom and helping teachers to provide visible evidence that they know how to plan, carry out instruction, how to manage a classroom, how to assess students, and how to help all children learn. So they're spreading.
To this point, have any other states adopted a work sample? You said Colorado's looking at them. Others are looking at them. Have any others adopted that process?
You mean as a licensing
yes.
piece? Chair Flores and Representative Dahlem, I can't speak to that specifically. I do know that there are other pieces in place. For instance, the state of, I believe it's Iowa and possibly Connecticut, use other kinds of classroom observation and portfolio pieces for judging teacher effectiveness, but not many other states as a statewide requirement.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Additional questions? Ms. Samick, can you tell us how the members of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission are selected and or mm-hmm. how the board commission is
sure.
comprised?
There are 17 members of the commission. 8 of those members are practicing classroom teachers, equally divided between elementary and secondary. 4 of those are school administrators. 2 of them are higher education representatives, and let's see, the others are general public members. Those who represent constituent groups, for example, I can speak directly to higher education. We generally sort of look around our constituency and talk about people who are knowledgeable, who have history of what has happened in the commission, who are visionary, which is fairly important. And through our Oregon Independent Colleges Association and from the Oregon University System, they are supported to the governor's office. But the appointments are actually made through the office of the governor. So they're not elected per se. They're not paid, they're all volunteered, and they are appointed to the commission.
They're appointed by the governor. They do have to go through an approval process by the Senate, do
yes,
I?
They
is
do.
That correct?
Yes, they do.
And I guess I would just call to your attention your comment of Dr. Green that the commingling of elected politics and the TSPC, there might be a little bit of a contradiction in that consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vicki Chamberlain, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to answer your questions. We haven't received any direct information about why this bill was put forward this session. Last session, when it was introduced, we had an idea that the concerns about the agency had to do with service, and we've committed ourselves to service. I brought information that I brought to you the first time you met with me, but it was in the very beginning of the conference. And it has to do with the statistics about our workload and our staff and how we're picked. But perhaps you could help me help you.
Madam Chair?
Questions. Representative Farr, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki, I just have a question regarding the political issue, because I'm looking here, number 2, the size and makeup of the commission regulated by the professionals, and then it goes on to explain. Is political party part of the process? Is that...
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, no, it is not. Dr. Samick started to explain the process. The stakeholder groups pretty much select their representatives, and the governor's office works with folks that way. It's not a done deal. They do review their credentials independently. The governor's office does. But the teacher representatives come from the Oregon Education Association. The administrator representatives come from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. The private colleges pick theirs. The public universities pick theirs. And then the public members are truly public folks who express interest to be on the commission. If you'll look at the handout there, one of the public members must be a school board member, and that person is picked by the Oregon School Boards Association. But on a Republican Democrat Party basis, that's not a consideration.
Follow up. So it really is it meant to be a nonpartisan commission?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, absolutely, as far as I can tell. Madam Chair, may I? On those boards where they intentionally select party representative, you'll see a neutral. You'll see, like, a request that selections come from, like, pro-labor, pro-management, a neutral. We don't have that.
I have a couple questions until somebody else comes forward with them, if you don't mind. According to ORS 342, and aside from the teacher licensing fees that you collect, and I understand that you're a fee-based or fee-funded entity, you have the opportunity to establish and collect fees regarding initial applications and review of those initial applications that are outside the actual license fee. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure what you mean. We have absolutely no independence to set a fee outside of the fee schedule. I don't have the fee bill in front of me, but the only thing that is may fall in that category is we have the ability to charge up to $200 for an alternative assessment, and we also have the ability to charge a fee for a beginning teacher assessment. But that was linked to a program that was funded in the Department of Ed that hasn't been funded for a number of years, and that particular fee line has not been used for as long as that grant hasn't been funded. We have a statutory cap in our fees. Our fees for in-state applicants are $75, and our fees for out-of-state applicants are $90. Our late fees are $15 a month, up to $135 total, and our licensure fees are locked in statute at $42, which we're working on because the state police increased their fee. Our renewals are $75 for every educator, whether it's a 3-year license or a 5-year license. That would be $75 for 5 years, or $75 for 3 years. So it's a fairly reasonable licensure fee, either $15 a year or $25 a year. And I'll mention that the out-of-state licenses are charged more because we do evaluate them differently because we don't have any knowledge of the programs they come from. So we scrutinize their curriculum fairly critically and spend more time on those files.
According to statute, then not charge a teacher assessment fee for beginning teachers?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That was related to a specific grant statute for a beginning teacher program, and it had to do with a formal assessment that doesn't exist anymore and that we never use.
And could you tell me then, in regard to a professional organization certification fund, do you have such a fund within your bailiwick?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do. That was set up a few years before I arrived here, and it was set up as a mechanism to collect money. I get like fall from heaven, I think, money, but to fund teachers to take national boards tests. It costs about $2,200 per application for national board certification. And there are states that support national board certification very well. And this mechanism in that statute was set up for us to collect money. And actually, Washington Mutual did give us some grants, and the national boards has given grants to that fund, and the NEA has contributed money to that fund. It has a current balance of $28,000, and it is spent exclusively on assisting teachers to achieve national boards. And it's managed by a group of educators who are national board certified and interested in doing that. It's in our office. We audit it. We have a staff member in charge of working with those folks, but it's not very big.
Thank you. And then could you tell us a little bit about professional development in regard to who oversees the requirements to keep up the teacher skills and how those plans are created and who's responsible for them?
Okay. The way the rules are designed right now, Madam Chair, is that there's two ways for this to be monitored. It's either monitored through the school district, and the school district then has a plan, and the school district then requires that each of their educators submit to the plan. And then when the teacher renews, the chief administrator of the district signs off on the teacher's completion of the district's plan. If the district doesn't want to have a formal plan, the second mechanism is they can allow each individual educator to set up their own plan. And the rules require that the educator work with an administrator who oversees their development of their plan so it's consistent with the district. And I wasn't specifically involved in licensure when that came around, but I do recall quite clearly when I was doing other education things at the time that the idea is the desire was to have districts have a lot of control so that teachers, if the district so chose, would be doing professional development that's relevant to the curriculum there or relevant to the programs there or relevant to skills that the district wanted them to pick up. The major districts have plans, and they're very comprehensive. It tends to be the smaller districts that allows the individual to do their own plan.
Do you keep track of how many school districts supervise that plan and how many allow teachers to devise their own plan?
We have a list of the districts that have plans, which would then by default be the other way. But what we do not do, I'll just be perfectly blunt with you, is we do not check off each educator's professional development, each list, each workshop, or whatever it is we do. We're counting on the administrators to do that. And on the renewal form for every educator, at the bottom of their statement from the district, it says, I have reviewed and sign off that this educator has completed their professional development requirements.
If the teacher is responsible for implementing their own professional development plan, who then controls the money that they receive for that professional development plan?
Madam Chair, the money is always controlled by the district. I mean, whether they reimburse for that or not. So most times reimbursement for professional development is part of the collective bargaining agreement unless the district successfully in some way acquires a grant to fund specific professional development. But all funding for professional development is independent in the districts, and it is across the board. And I'm certain it's the state now in 05 that it was in 03, and that was that professional development is one of the first things to go in budgets when budgets are tight. And so many teachers are funding, and educators, administrators have to do it also, funding their own professional development. Unless, like I said, the district is able to invest in a group activity or get a grant.
But that is a component of some collective bargaining discussions.
Correct, well. It is. The fact that the district does not reimburse professional development does not waive the requirement that the educator acquire it.
I see. And Well, that one just left the track. So Representative Gollum, I know this is the question.
You talked about national boards, and it brought to mind state standards. And tell me, Vicki, how if we discovered that there's a major component in social studies that all teachers should have, what's the process for implementing rules on teacher standards by the commission? How does that work?
Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, I'm hearing you ask me about content. Is that what you're asking me, like social studies content?
Or any standard that that all teachers have to have before they can receive licensure.
What's the process?
Yes.
The process is we generally put together a work group of stakeholders, which involve all the representatives that are on the commission. It's more productive to work in work groups outside of the actual commission meetings because it would be like you having a work group in here. Well, it was similar to your other bill where the work group went away and brought back a proposal. For major licensure, for example, setting up the standards for the initial license that everyone would have, that took years of work with the work groups. Then the proposals are brought to the commission, and we have to hold public hearings just like you do on bills because they become enacted in rules. And we generally have one or two hearings per major bill. There haven't been, that we have new revision, not to the standards, but new revisions to licensure because we were directed to review our licensure by last session's House Education Committee and made some, I think, fairly reasonable, flexible changes to that. But we had to go through the hearings, and we did. We had an all-day meeting with the stakeholders to get all the issues out on the table. It wasn't just the commission, for example, coming up with the solution. And it was painful, a lot like sometimes legislation can be, but I think, you know, we came to an outcome that was good for folks. We do the same with content standards. We're in the middle of this. We're starting with the national standards, and then we are bringing the stakeholders in and working them over and saying, does this fit Oregon? And then we're submitting them for public hearing.
If somebody wanted to question one of the standards, what's the oversight process? Where do they go? What do they do?
Well, the state law requires all agencies to respond to concerns about anything in a rule. And so the process has been, and this happens, is that the person petitions for a hearing on the rule to be heard on the issue. We're required by law to open a hearing and receive the testimony on it. And we have to respond to them within 60 days about when we will be having that hearing.
And then where's that? Is there an appellate process to that, or is that the end game?
To the rule?
Mm-hmm.
No, there is not an appellate process. It's
so that is the end of the process. Is there any elected officials involved in the process at all anywhere on oversight or implementation or the beginning process?
Madam Chair, Representative Dallum, no. We are just like the other 26 licensure boards in the state who are overseen by constituency boards. And as far as I'm aware, there are no elected officials involved in any of them.
Thank you.
Jump back on the track.
Okay.
Thank you. Is it ever a concern or even within a realm of possibility that a teacher who might be nearing retirement and considering options for after teaching would use any of their professional development money to help prepare them for life outside academia? For instance, a teacher nearing retirement might use their professional development money to take a real estate class.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we require that the professional development be related to the license. I think all licensure boards do that for professional development.
Is there early sign-off then on what is being applied for or engaged in?
Madam Chair, I don't understand your question.
A teacher who is undergoing professional development classes, do they have to make an application to anyone? You said they either are supervised by their school district board or they set the plan. So if they set the plan, do they make the choices and submit a request for reimbursement, or is it approved before they go down that path?
Madam Chair, I can only speak to what happened when I was teaching in my district, and that was that, and we didn't have the formal professional development then, but I was a teacher who was required to get a fifth year to continue to teach in the high school, and I had to let my administrators know in advance that I was going to go to school and that what I was taking and that I was working on my program. And I also knew in advance that only $400 a year would be advanced toward that. So that generally covered about one graduate class, and I knew I was going to have to pay for the rest. And I think that's not unsimilar to how it happens. Back to the plans, if I were today working in that district and my district didn't have a plan, I would have to report to somebody, here's my plan, here are the courses I plan to take. I would, I'm sure, have a pretty good idea what the district would be willing to reimburse. But the idea is that I'm not just out taking whatever it is and the district has to accept it, that there is the oversight's through the person I have to report to.
Thank you. That does help.
To follow that up.
You mind?
With the plan that the teacher develops by themselves in absence of a school plan, does the school district keep those plans on file? Are they required to keep them on file?
Madam Chair, Representative Dallum, we don't regulate how they keep their records on those. We assume when the administrator signs off on the renewal sheet that the educator completed that work, that they're doing their accounting and that they're being honest about it, and that they have worked out the method for how they're going to do that. It's very much self-audit. We don't audit whether or not that actually happened.
One last question, and I'm sorry I don't recall from the information that you had given us in January and from the sheet here, but do you have track or record of how many teachers are licensed to teach math or science or English?
Madam Chair, yes, I can actually come up with that information by the morning. We have an excellent electronic system right now that allows us to track that. My question would be, do you want 7 through 12, 9 through 12? That would be helpful because we do have some related to grade assignments.
7 through 12.
Okay. So you want math, science, and English?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair.
And do you have, of those who are licensed to teach in those areas, do you have information as well? And I think you did give us some discussion earlier about those that might not be currently teaching, those that would be licensed in those areas and not teaching.
Madam Chair, yes, we can do that. Our employment information is as good as it was when it was reported to the Department of Education in November. You know, and so it's likely to be pretty darn close to what would be going on today in the classroom. And so what I can give you are the number of math teachers who are active. These would be active math licenses who are employed and the active math licenses that are not.
Representative Roland?
Follow up on that question, because there are people who have become counselors, let their math certificate go away, but they have continuously been licensed, so they could get that renewed. Is that not correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Roland, that is correct, and we would not likely report them. We would report them. We would be tracking them based on their current license. So... Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, we have the information, though, on the educator. I mean, it is actually available to the public that you can go in and see what licenses people have held.
And by the same token, did you give us information in January, too, and I'm sorry if I'm asking for information that you have already provided, about teachers that are hired from outside of the state in those areas as well, and the numbers that you hire, perhaps, that are licensed to teach, let's say, math?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I can do that piece. I think we had that question asked of us once before. I can tell you that of all the new licenses that we issue every year for the last 3 years, 60% of the new licenses have been prepared, the people have come in have been prepared from out of state. And that would be all the licenses, the teachers, counselors, and administrators. Our 19 institutions that you heard about earlier are producing 40% of our new licenses. My point in that is that I'm not sure I could track precisely which of the licenses I gave you came from out of state at this point and which came from in state. Okay. Madam Chair, I'll ask. Sometimes my IT folks surprise me, and if they can, I will certainly ask.
Okay, and if you would provide all that information through Mr. Keller, I would appreciate it.
Okay.
Representative Dahl?
Yes, you talked about a closer look at teachers that come from outside the state. Do we have reciprocity on licensure with any states?
Representative Dallum, the reciprocity that Oregon has is identical to the other states, and that is we accept their programs. So, for example, and we would accept a test they took in another state if it was the same test we had and the passing score was at the level that we have. But every state is exactly that way. There is not any state that anybody from Oregon could go in and have complete reciprocity with. But that doesn't mean we're not working on some agreements. One of the discussions on the table, for example, is that Washington recently accepted our basic skills test for all teachers so that the Oregon teacher going to Washington would not have to retake it, and we're putting that back on the table. We'll be looking at things like that. Another thing that I've had conversations with some folks in Washington, Dr. Samick mentioned they were starting up a new board, would be trying to have reciprocity more directly on tests and adopting them together. We've looked at the student curriculum. It is not significantly different between the two states. And it's good for partner states to do that sort of thing. So, and we shared tests with California for a while, so there was some test reciprocity there. But each state requires so many different things. California requires the California history part, and it just varies state by state. So the reciprocity comes in that if they came to us from the University of Washington and they had taken their teacher preparation there, we wouldn't look again at it. They've completed teacher preparation, that's signed off. Now we're looking to see how they've demonstrated subject matter competency. Have they passed a test in it? And now with No Child Left Behind, we have a whole lot less flexibility than we used to in terms of signing off on their subject matter competency. Basic skills, we have Oregon has a first aid card requirement, which we've been working on, and we have the discrimination workshop requirement that's been there since the 70s. So, and that's sort of a taste of how it is when you go into every state.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry, I had skipped right over Deb Andrews. You had wanted to come up and testify as well.
Chairman Flores, members of the committee, I'm here in support of House Bill 3172. I look at whose needs are being served by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. We've heard about input from stakeholders. I think students and parents certainly are stakeholders of the TSPC. Education, for the most part, is a pretty closed shop. Most excellent teachers don't get up in front of the public and complain about the bureaucracy or what they see are problems. But a principal got up at City Club in front of 400 people at a luncheon and said, new teachers do not know how to teach children how to read. So the first thing they have to do at the school is teach the new teachers how to teach children how to read. My teacher friends that are near retirement are very concerned about the new teachers they see coming in. They're very concerned about that.
I heard the director of TSPC come before you months ago and report that everything is fine. Perhaps for student stakeholders, everything is not fine. I recently read an article in New York Times by the director of TSPC promoting cultural competency requirement of teachers. This is similar to research that was done 40 years ago by Coleman and Jenks in the southeastern United States on behalf of the Johnson administration. They concluded that poor and minority children had difficulty learning due to the effects of poverty, single-parent families, and a myriad of other factors. Teachers came to believe that it was not their responsibility if the children did not learn the curriculum. In a system of blame, no one is responsible for change. Current research by Sanders and Rivers shows that rigorous, challenging curriculum and effective teachers make all the difference for student learning, regardless of race or socioeconomic factors. For the director of TSPC to promote repeating the same miseducation mistake we've lived with for 40 years that has resulted in the much publicized achievement gap is unconscionable. Curriculum and instruction should be the focus of public education. According to the principal in Portland, new teachers do not know how to teach children how to read. We have to ask whose needs are being met by TSPC. Any questions?
Are there questions? Ms. Andrews, Representative Farr?
Ms. Andrews, I appreciate your comment that new teachers, or the comment of the principal that spoke to the City Club, that new teachers don't know how to teach children how to read. But it seems that this is really more of an issue for the Department of Education within the higher ed system than it is the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Licensure is a big part of the teacher preparation. It guides what the colleges offer. It is a guiding force in teacher preparation, and teacher preparation is just about the whole story.
Further questions?
One question, please. Your discussion of teachers not as prepared as they have been in the past. Do you have anything that you can show me that through Jim that says that? I'd like to read that.
I have the principal comment, and I will look through my materials at home, and I have the input from teacher friends about new teachers that are coming on.
But no comparative data from 65 to 95 or anything like that?
I have information on progressive education and the effects, the road we're going down as far as preparation and priority in education, if you're interested in that.
Yes, I would be.
Okay, thank you. I will get that to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Sanders. We will, close the public hearing on House Bill 3172. Oops, I apologize. We'll open that public hearing on House Bill 3172. Anyone else who might wish to testify?
I'm sorry, I didn't sign up.
I've participated in before.
I'm Nancy Watt. I'm the interim dean in the College of Education at Pacific University. I feel so compelled to say something after the last testimony because I was trained as a teacher 35 years ago. I've worked with teacher education at Pacific for 14 years. I was a part of the public school system for more than 20, where I was a teacher, a librarian, a vice principal, and a principal. I can say unequivocally from experience that our teachers that come out of our programs now know 20 times as much as I knew when I started teaching. Experienced teachers learn a lot, and they get better based on experience. Our new teachers get better based on experience also. I can assure you, they know more. They know how to assess. They know how to differentiate a curriculum so that you can prepare a curriculum that works for the lowest performing student. And I do want to say the highest performing student, but I will tell you that most school districts probably don't do as much for the talented and gifted students as they should. They do this in a classroom, sometimes with 40 students. I tell you truthfully, they do now what I couldn't do. They are prepared better. teachers leaving my university know how to teach reading, and they know how to teach reading with a very broad spectrum of programs, because when they get jobs, they don't know what kind of reading program is going to be in the school. They learn to look at all of the programs, to adapt them in the ways that they need to. It was unbearable for me to hear that our teachers are not well prepared. I won't speak for the 60% who come from out of state. I won't even speak for all of the universities. I'll speak for the teachers that come out of my university. I'm also a commissioner. I was selected by Oregon Independent Teachers Association, or OICA, to be their representative on the commission. As such, I work with all of the deans and directors from both the privates and the publics. And I will tell you that there's no greater commitment to education than those people exhibit. I've never seen a group of people more devoted to teaching teachers how to teach the students in our public schools. For most of us, it's more than just a job. It's a calling. And one of the things I tell my students is that I've done work in education for some 35 years. Not one day have I ever gotten up and thought I was going to work. It doesn't mean I wanted to go every day or that I liked what I dealt with every day. But work is something you do only for money. Teaching is something that you do because you have a commitment to students and to learning. I would still be moving irrigation pipe or picking strawberries were not for an education. I guess what I want you to know is that the people who sit on teacher standards and practices are all committed to education. It's not what I would consider a political body. As a matter of fact, probably if it were, I wouldn't be there, because I believe so deeply in what we do and so deeply in the fact that we prepare teachers in order for the students and the children of Oregon to learn and to do well. I have a tendency to get maudlin about education because I consider it so very, very important. In spite of what a principal might have said, in spite of what many teachers think, I don't want to leave you believing that our new teachers are not well prepared. There are some statistics and a survey that was done by Linda, help me,
It was done by the Oregon Quality Assurance and Teaching Grant Program through the Chancellor's Office about 4 years ago.
And that survey is available to all of you, and we can get it to you if you'd like. That indicates overwhelmingly that our Oregon teachers are very well prepared, and the principals believe that. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. I have a quick comment before you close the
presentation
part.
I just want to say that Friday, this last Friday, was the National Legislators Back to School Day, and I attended my early morning session was at Fairfield Elementary School, and I read to three elementary school classes a book called Duck for President, a really fun Caldecott nominee, and at the kindergarten classes, I was reading to them, you know, we were talking about books, and I said, oh, but you're not learning to read yet. The kindergarten teacher said, no, that's not true. Almost every child in my class knows how to read, and that is in a school that would be considered high risk based on our earlier bill. 75% of those students qualify for free or reduced lunch.
Well, thank you very much. Anyone else choose to comment, testify? Sure. We'll just hold that baby open. Please come forward.
Good afternoon. I'm Betty McChesney House, and I'm usually here representing the American Association of University Women. But I couldn't help kind of commenting on the lack of education that we there are supposed to have. I was a teacher. I'm retired for a few years now. I was educated in Lake Forest, Illinois at a women's college, Women's Catholic College. Came to Oregon, attended the University of Oregon, have a degree from there, and have a master's degree from what's now WOO, used to be OCE, in special education. And I think the most interesting part of this is that I am 66, so I was, you know, teaching, first year of teaching, 46 years ago. Yes, there's a difference in teaching reading. But let me tell you what that difference is. I taught a program called 20-20-20, and it meant that I had three reading groups in my fourth grade classroom of 50 students. And we've spent 20 minutes with a group, and the other two groups were doing something silently, an activity or silent guided reading. And then we switched so that they spent two parts of the hour working on independent activities and one part with us. Today, that particular reading method has been duplicated in the Salem-Keizer area on computer. So, yes, a lot of the same things have been translated and are in a little different form than they were, and they're still working. And, yes, I would like to agree. I have several grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and my great-grandchildren are now, you know, getting to the point where they're in school, and, yes, they can read. And, yes, they have some wonderful programs around in all of the different states for that. But I want you to know that, yes, our new teachers are getting a wonderful education here and are doing their very level best, and many of the school districts have wonderful mentoring programs as well so that they can get help from the head teacher in their area. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Chesney House? Thank you very much. Okay, gavel's going down. Thank you. We'll close our public hearing on House Bill 3172. No further business to come before this committee. We will close the House Education Committee. And we'll see you Wednesday.
Thank you so much.